I'm so happy to be here today with Balazs Koegele and Annie Crawford, and we are going to talk about AI. And we're going to come at it from a slightly different direction. So Balazs is the head of AI research for Huawei in Paris. And Annie is a C.S. Lewis scholar and has a particular interest in the imagination. So, in fact, right now, Annie's working on an article for a book about Till We Have Faces, and maybe we'll have a few minutes to talk about that at the end. But I'd like to start, first of all, with Balazs just giving us a very small summary of how AI works so we have a framework to work in. And then Annie's going to give us a summary of two of Lewis's essays. One is called Transposition, and the other one is called Meditation on a Tool Shed. So take it away, Balazs.
Okay. Thank you, Karan. Hi, Annie, and thank you very much for inviting me. I'm really excited because I have no idea what's going to happen in this conversation. It's pretty interesting to connect such seemingly far topics, and I have a lot of, my big brain is, buzzing with connections, so I'm very curious where this leads us when the three of us will actually sort of brainstorm about this. So you asked me about explaining a little bit how AI works. And I'm not going to explain all AI. I will probably concentrate on language because this is what this is about. And I'm not going to explain also how the latest tools work, like DeepSeek and all those reasoning tools, because that adds something on the top of what the main thing is. But I will try to explain how the basic thing works, like let's say up to GPT-4, how AI generates language. Okay. And I've been in AI for 30 years, so it's been a long dream actually to do this. And I was there in the beginning where we had some very simple models generating language, and they were very silly. But we were very excited about that. So maybe I start with that. So the idea was to, it's statistics basically. So take a big corpus of text and look at word frequencies, right? Now, we have a vocabulary, like an English vocabulary, maybe 40,000 words. It depends how big the corpus is, that all the words that are there. But of course, the corpus is much bigger than the vocabulary because words repeat, right? So the first thing is you can just count the number of words like nice and black and cat, make a big table of frequencies, and then draw words according to those frequencies randomly, right? That would be pretty silly. It would give you a work salad with words that occur more commonly than others, but otherwise there would be no sense in it. I wouldn't even call it strange poetry. It would be nothing, right? So that wouldn't work, but this is the basic idea. We are counting words. But now let's say instead of counting words, what I will try to do is I take one word, I fix it like nice, and I count all the occurrences of nice in the corpus, and I look at what follows nice, right? And then I can make a frequency table and draw. I say nice, and then I draw from that frequency table. Now I can do it for every word in the vocabulary. Okay, so for every word in the vocabulary, you have the frequency of words that followed that one, right? And so that would give you less of a word salad. It would give you meaningful couples, like nice cat running, and then after running, you can have in running in. House in the house, and that would make like a meaningful sentence, but it also gives you things that don't really make sense, especially if you go beyond those short segments of text, right? But this is the basic idea. The rest is scaling. The rest is scaling in computation and databases, and of course some algorithmic ideas, because this doesn't work. So this First of all, it doesn't work because it doesn't really give you interesting text. And second, it doesn't work because if you really want to make something meaningful, you have to have a bigger and bigger context. Context by context means what you look like in the past. And if you take a big context and you start counting the number of occurrences of that particular text, you will get to one very easily, very fast. And zero, actually, most of the sequences never occur if the sequence is long, right? So this doesn't work because there is not enough data in the world to fill that big table. So what we started to do is to design functions which had the same form. It looks at the context and it tries to predict the next word, but these functions became more sophisticated. And these functions, currently called neural networks, because their internal mechanisms look a little bit like how the brain works. And there are a lot of other things like what we call attention mechanism, where you can have a very long context, but to predict what the next word is, you need to find what is the more relevant word in this big context. And this is what we call attention in machine learning, in AI. And so concentrating on those important words, predict the next word. So this is what basically modern LLMs are doing. And the rest is just scaling in the sense that the corpus had to be really big. So right now we're basically feeding everything that was ever written at let's say, meaningful quality text from the internet into these machines. And the function, this mapping from the context to the next word, is also enormous. It has billions, 10 billions, up to 100 billion parameters. But the actual sort of like setting those parameters are, the principle is the same. It's a statistical principle. We're trying to set those parameters so the predicted word matches the next word in the corpus on which it's trained. Right? So now this is still tricky, and this is where AI gets tricky because the corpus is still as a corpus. So what you want to do is generate new text that has never appeared because somebody asks a new question or starts some text and wants to continue, writes a novel, a fiction. That piece of text has not been in the corpus. So we cannot just memorize the corpus. And this is what AI calls generalization, and this is a big thing because that's complicated, like theoretically, even metaphysically complicated on what we mean by that, right? So basically, the way you could imagine how this works today is that you have this context, and instead of predicting the next word, because by the way, these, once they are trained, they are deterministic, these functions, right? So if it was deterministic, it would always say the same thing given a context, but this is not what happens. What we do is basically we are trying to learn, again, like a frequency table of next word given the context. This is called a distribution over the words. Like it's a probability for every word in the vocabulary. What is the probability that this word follows this context? Now, this probability is very, what we call skewed. Right? Because the word we expect after a context, it's not the full vocabulary. It's not where you say something, what I'm expecting as your next utterance is not one out of 40,000 words. It's much smaller. Right? And this has to be much smaller, otherwise it would be overwhelmingly complicated to understand language. And this is actually this, there is a measure that's called perplexity, which actually measures this, and it's been measured on humans, and it's hovering around 10, which is pretty interesting. Like I'm listening to something in my mind, and I have a model that the next word that you will say comes from a set of about 10 words. If it's outside, it's probably because you're talking about something I have no idea and I don't understand what you will say. And if it's less, then basically, language would use its communication purpose because it would be too deterministic. So it's a very interesting matrix, this 10. And the current language model has actually reached that level. Okay, so what happens when LLMs actually generate text is that they take the context, they digest it, they have this function that outputs this probability over like or the set of 10 words that would follow that context. And then what happens? LLMs pick one randomly. And that's for me is a very important like theoretical point of how LLMs work. And probably we can get there, but it's probably a big difference between how we generate language and how LLMs generate language.
Well, I just have to ask a question here though. So
absolutely.
If it's picking a word randomly, that has now changed the context of what the LLM is working with. So now it has a
yes.
set with a random thing in there. So how on earth does it ever get back to the original context?
It doesn't. It takes the context, it continues it, and it's recursive in that sense. You are right. So it generates one word, and then it puts it into the context, and it asks the function again, what is the next word? Right? But each time it might be a small set. And if it's a good LLM, and it is a good LLM, like right now we can have language models that generate text that are pretty consistent on paragraph, even longer level, we can make sense of it. So it has something, it communicates some information, which is basically, in my view, as a sort of like database query of this huge corpus that we've ever written in a very digestible way. But this means that those words that has non-zero probability, that following the context, they are all plausible. It means that any of those words could follow the context, and we would make sense with any of those continuations. But it's still random. It's still random. And this is state of the art. And then there are some like flavors of LLMs where you change this distribution according to some goal. You try to bias it towards some kind of answer, or you can put some fixed context called the system prompt into the LLMs that you don't see, but the LLM sees. So its context is actually longer, and you can put instructions in that context. And you can, tweak it in other ways, but at the end of the day, it's still a random draw from a pretty good distribution of words.
Well, so if I ask it to write a, if I give it a bunch of ideas and I say, okay, now write this into a poem in the style of William Shakespeare, write a sonnet in the style of William Shakespeare. Now it's drawing from a particular set of data that comes from Shakespeare's work. Is that how it works?
Not explicitly. The fact that you mentioned Shakespeare will drive this huge humongous function into the space of texts of Shakespeare, and then it will skew the distribution towards those texts, so it will look like Shakespeare. Yeah.
Okay. Because I had a really funny experience with Grok a couple of weeks ago, where I got Grok in the space of about five different books that I wanted to talk about, and so I'm discussing these five books and the patterns and the connections between them. And then when we got done with that discussion, I said, okay, now can you put this idea into a sonnet in the style of William Shakespeare? And it comes back to me and says, well, here it is, but I have to warn you, it's a little bit florid. That is so funny.
What does it mean? I'm sorry, it's my English.
Florid means a little bit overly dramatic and,
I see.
a little bit too much.
Ah, okay.
And I read it and I came back and I said, yeah, you're exactly right. It's a little bit too florid. So I said, let's back it off and try instead four stanzas in the style of Blake. And so it came back with four stanzas in the style of Blake. I mean, it's pretty scary.
No, I mean, what's scary about this is that this very simple principle that I just described generates so consistent text. I'm also, very surprised, even as a researcher, how good they became. Yet, I think there's some pretty deep difference between LLMs and us, the way we
Yes,
generate
yes.
language.
Yeah, and we're gonna, that's what we're gonna talk about.
Well, actually, can I ask a clarifying question? And
Sure.
forgive me for being a little
No, of
slow.
course.
My husband's an engineer, and I do try to keep up with these things the best I can, but it's not my field. So, can you just repeat so I can be really clear? Because at one point you said, once it's trained, it's deterministic. And then you talked about how randomness enters into the output. So can you just clarify for me so I'll try and really grasp it, where the random element comes from?
This is the question, actually. It's the right question. So it's generates the distribution deterministically and then draws from it. So the randomness is at the very end of the process. So let's say it has nice cat and black as the three words where it puts non-zero probability, nice with 0 2, black with 0 5, and cat with 0 3. Those numbers are deterministic. They are determined by the context. Okay, but then which one it chooses is random. So that, I mean, that we
But
can talk about that too.
how's that choice made then? Like, what is the cause of
And that's exactly where I
choosing?
was getting it. So it could be really random if we use some kind of quantum process to make it really random, but it's not, of course, because that would be too expensive. So what we do is it's called pseudo-random. It's an algorithm. So it's actually also deterministic, but it's complicated. It can be seeded by, for example, the actual time when you ask it. And so it will be deterministic given the timestamp, which is probably something that's random compared to what you're asking. Or it can have a fixed seed, in which case it will be deterministic too, but since we don't like it because next time we want the same context, we want something else, especially if we use it for like creative writing. We try to make it really random looking. So it's like it means that if you ask the same context 100 times, then about 50 times it will say nice, 30 times it will say cat, and 20 times it will say black. But
Yeah.
it's not like ontologically random. It's
Right.
not like
Okay.
physically random, but it's random looking, yeah. But it's at the very end of the process.
Okay, that's helpful. Let me ask one more clarifying question. Hopefully it's helpful to the other, neophytes, lay people out there. So in trying to learn about AI and computers and how they work for the sake of on the humanity side, understanding how they relate to human intelligence, I've come across what is called the frame problem, right? So a program, and I'll just say this is how I understand it. Please correct me if I'm wrong. A program, an algorithm might come to, in its processing, a point where there's kind of two equal options, and that can get a program stuck. And so that you would insert into the program a randomizer so that if it comes up to A and B and everything in its deterministic code makes those equal, it triggers the randomizer so that the computer doesn't get stuck within the frame problem. So, and that my understanding of the randomizer is, well, I think like you're saying, that is it something where the process by which the choice is made would feel random to us because the complexity of the coding behind, within the black box, let's say, are too complicated for us to track. Is that how a randomizer works?
I mean, this is you are getting really at the heart of the argument, actually. There's a lot of so first of all, there's a lot of randomization used in computer science for the reason you just mentioned, and where the trained LLM is deterministic. When we train it, given the corpus, there's a lot of randomization in it because to set those 10 billion parameters, you need to randomize. Otherwise, it gets stuck in solutions that are not good. So that leads to a lot of technical stuff. But basically, randomization is a basic tool to use in optimization in general when you want to optimize anything, but also what we call regularization. So this is what makes sure that that there will be some generalization learned by this function. It's just not just memorizing the corpus. So that's another reason why we do use randomization at training time. But training is done by, you know, OpenAI for 3 months on big clusters, and then it's fixed. And then what happens is what I described previously. Now, your second question about how we, you know, I don't know if where even start, because it's a general question for me, and I'm actually getting to certain hypotheses on it leads to consciousness and everything. Like, so it's pretty complicated to express, but what you're just saying, this is what I've been thinking about in the last weeks, is that a lot of times something looks random to us because we don't know what's going on. It's a lack of knowledge, right? And this is where statistics comes in. Statistics tries to model that lack of knowledge with laws, and we can manipulate. There is an algebra there, so we can actually reason in this probabilistic place, but that the root of it is phenomena where which looks random, okay? But it turns out that and this is getting into really, really language, in that I can imagine up to the distribution of the next word that we have sort of a language model in our head. And I think we do, because of this perplexity that you can measure with cognitive science experiments, like how many words do you expect in a given context? Mm-hmm. But then the way we generate the next word is not random. It is, I say it because I want to say something, right? I want to communicate some information to you. And that some information needs a space of possibilities, because if there were no possibilities, there would be no information to communicate. It would be always the same. I would say something that you would know I would say. So there has to be some uncertainty in your mind about what I'm going to say. Otherwise, you would never learn about my internal intent of communicating something. Okay, so there has to be a space. This perplexity of how many words you expect cannot be one. It has to be bigger than that, right? If it's too big again, then we cannot communicate for other reason, because what I'm saying is too complicated for you. But it has to be small, but not one. And then, but I'm not picking those words randomly. I'm picking them because I want to say something. And this depends on my internal world, which is inaccessible to you. Mm-hmm. And this is why I want to say something to you, because you cannot just be me, right? So it's what I'm talking about is basically classical information theory, communication, etc. But on top of it, I think there is something that's always stays internal to us, and this is what we want to communicate. And this principle, I think it goes everywhere. It goes even,
well, it's next to Darwinism. So much of my background is, as some of my background is, looking philosophically at Darwinism, because mm-hmm. what you hear Darwinists say is, you know, life is generated by random natural selection acting on random mutations. Well, really, you dig into what you have to realize is that science is grounded in philosophy, and that even scientists are using language soaked in metaphor, right? And that really randomness is not a cause. It's a name for I don't know what.
Exactly.
Variation was not caused by I don't know what. That variation was caused by something, right? And so, and again, within the field of Darwinism, one thing I'm always looking at and talking about is how intentionality, purpose, is actually hidden within the discourse of life, no matter how much mm-hmm. we try to eradicate it through the illusion of random, you know, using language of randomness. And that connects to what you're saying, is how do you choose the next word? It's because there's an internal reality, let's say mind, that has intentionality, that is and this is where we can get to the language of, that is transposing the internal desire, intentionality, thought into the external, the mode of language. And I think, to come back to AI, that the mystery is how that's happening within the LLMs, right? And my hunch is that it's just layers of complexity and randomizers that are opaque to us, but that the let's say electrical causality and programming substratum is still there, determining you know, the language that the LLM will give us, but it has an appearance to us on the outside of randomness or intentionality, because we can't penetrate with our own consciousness the layers of causality actually at work.
Yeah, I agree. What I would add, like a very detailed technical thing, is that I could imagine that this is intentional, that just, let's say, for modeling purposes, that what, when we want to say something, we have like this LLM in our mind that generates the plausible next words. And that's also opaque how it happens, because it's in, it's our brain, so it's even opaque to our consciousness. But then what happens, it's still that there is a conscious choice of which one I pick, whereas the LLM picks it randomly. And it picks it randomly because there is no way it can model in my internal processes how I generate the next word. And second, because it doesn't really want to say anything, for the same reason, because it doesn't have an internal word.
I wonder if it'd be helpful to look at the transposition essay to summarize
I
that.
Think yes.
And then we could start to make some of those connections. But Balaj, that was a super helpful summary of AI. And I appreciate the chance to get to ask my question.
I also appreciate the possibility to talk to you, because I think what you know is as important in this.
Okay, so Lewis's essay Transposition, Lewis is a Platonist, and so his metaphysical model includes a hierarchy of reality. That for Lewis, there is there's this material world, but then there's also a invisible world, a world of forms or ideas or principalities. And Transposition is his essay exploring a way to articulate the way that the worlds integrate, the way that ideas and forms can be translated into, transposed into material realities. And of course, you know, there I've kind of, you see the two basic levels in the metaphysical hierarchy, the world of ideas and forms, and then the material, but there's also, it's fractal, you know, there's many layers between what Plato would say is the ultimate good, for Lewis would be the divine, and the way that form increasingly manifests with increasing complexity into the material world. So in Transposition, and this is classic Lewis, is one thing I appreciate about him so much, is that he takes like Aquinas does this. Let's look at our common experience, something we all know, and then use that as an analogy to understand this idea. And so in Transposition, he talks about his experience of having a stomach flutter, you know, a flutter in your stomach, that this one physical feeling at the biological level, he'd experienced in two different ways. One when feeling fear, and one when feeling, you know, joy or maybe love. And so he notices that on the higher internal emotional level, he's feeling different things that get communicated at the physical level, but that the one physical manifestation or experience, the stomach flutter, can represent several different meanings at the higher level. He gives another analogy of the pianist, and I find this one personally to be the most helpful, where we can imagine an orchestra piece. Oh, forgive me for my lack of knowledge of symphonies, but you know, a Beethoven symphony played by an orchestra is going to have a wide complexity of sounds. We have the flutes and the cello and the bassoon and all of these different sounds playing a particular song and harmonies and rhythms at the symphony level. But it can be communicated at the level of a piano, where we have more limited numbers of keys, and yet those same notes, melodies, harmonies can be communicated down a level at the level of the piano. And so what Lewis calls that transposition, where one feeling or reality gets communicated, one higher feeling or higher reality gets communicated at the lower level. And where he explores in the, another example would be, you know, a painting or a drawing. If we had, I can look out my window right now, I'm in Edinburgh, and see a building on the corner of a street in Edinburgh. And I could sit here and I could draw that. The reality of the building is more complex and greater, but I can still represent it somewhat well on a two-dimensional piece of paper. So that's his idea of transposition. And what he's really interested in is the implications in terms of mind, metaphysics, spirituality, because Lewis is often working to fight against reductive materialism, this modernism that wants to see all of reality as ultimately reducible to mere molecules in motion. And so what he's trying to say is that, so he's looking at the way, so he says that from the perspective of the lower level, let's take the piano example, because I think this one is helpful. If I am only working from the lower level, if I'm only hearing the pianist play the symphony, there's no way for me, having only heard the piano version, only known the piano version, to perceive or imagine or know the symphony version. And so he says, if I'm looking at the piano version, all I see is the particular keys being played. There's no way for me to have perceived the higher looking from the bottom, looking from the lower. And he draws an analogy from that to the perspective of the materialist. If I'm only looking at things as at this lower level, as atoms moving around, then of course I will never see the higher realities that are at work. And I think that that's similar, Blaj, to what you were saying about, you know, you as a speaker who's wanting to communicate through language, I will never be able to know your internal thoughts and intentions that are inspiring you to choose the next word that you speak. I'll only know the next word that you speak. And so from my perspective, that might look deterministic or inevitable, because whatever happened is what happened. But if you consider it from the inside, from your experience, your internal experience of intentionality, you know that there's a higher level of reality going on, a higher level of intentionality and meaning and experience behind the way that it is transposed into the language that I hear. So that's kind of an overview of his transposition, which you hear, Karen, I don't know if you want me to talk about meditation and a tool shed, but connects to
that's
his idea.
Where it fits, right? Yeah.
Yeah, that's Meditation in a Tool Shed is basically a very short little essay where C.S. Lewis says, there are at least two modes of knowing. This, the outside mode of knowing that we see in the material world, and the internal mode of knowing that we experience as conscious beings. He gives an example of pain. So a doctor could, from the outside, analyze pain by noting a patient's physical responses, looking at the analyzing the look on their face, or doing a brain scan and seeing what neurons light up in the sense of pain. But none of that would give the doctor knowledge of what pain is unless he had also experienced pain from the inside. And so Lewis's main point in Meditation in a Tool Shed is that both that the modern world has really prioritized this external analytical way of knowing things as object and has dismissed the whole mode of internal understanding. And his proposal is that we need both. We have to acknowledge legitimacy of internal modes of knowing again, and then look for ways to better integrate those two modes, right? The extreme example is that people who have become so analytical and accustomed to looking at things from the outside that they've denied the reality of consciousness, which is the most obvious fact of reality that we know from the inside. And so he's wanting to find ways to reconcile those together. And I think transposition is one of his proposals for the ways that the two modes of knowing and the two the various levels of reality integrate in our experience.
I 100% agree with you. So many thoughts. But maybe the last one is, it maps to John Verweck's propositional and perspectival ways of knowing. What I like to say is, what we call it, you have the scientific method for the propositional, and that its goal is actually not even, it's not transpositional, right? It's really digitally recording what we know. And there is what I call it shamanistic ways of knowing, because there is one role of the old shamans who that was, you know, the tribe got stuck because the sheep went somewhere, or the deer, they don't know where to hunt and where are the deers, you know. So the shaman did not just try to read the books and calculate where the deers went, but it actually became the deer, right? Put some deer skin on, went out in the forest and started to behave as a deer and became the deer from the inside. It's like this huge empathic move, and then came back to the tribe and said the deer is there, you know, and the deer was there. And this role stayed, like, for Darwinist reason, because probably this works. And it's true that this kind of way of knowing, it's pretty anti-scientific. I don't want to, like, oppose it to it, but it's a different way of knowing. And I, you know, that's why I love, like, Jonathan Pajot, because he has a scientific mind almost for me, but talking about this other way of knowing, you know, like the symbolic way. So that was my last thought. But before, what I wanted to say is this, it's related. And I had this idea when I was listening to the transpositions, is that it's basically Michael Levin's bow tie argument, but it's not, he's not the only one, but we know this from information theory, and we know this from AI and a lot of different things. That, so basically, when we want some memory, we want to store some information, that information will be always filtering the complexity of reality because it's digital, right? It can be genes, it can be a book, it can be something I say, it can be a neural pattern in my mind that constitutes a memory. So it has a lot of manifestations, but it's always a filtering, a mapping to into a space which is less rich than the space it maps into. And there is, of course, relevance realization and all kind of complex things that going on to actually construct these, or you have evolution for genes or whatever, like, by you know, that all those things are true, like biochemistry is not false just because what I'm saying. But what happens is that you have this imprint of the past in the present, and every living organism, I don't have access to the past as a body, right? Because we think so much, we think that our memories are the past, but our memories are not the past. Our memories are the imprints of the past in the present, filtered through a lot of things. And sometimes what we have to do, when, for example, you say something or the doctor hears that I have pain, the doctor has to internally reconstruct that pain to understand what happens with this sort of shamanistic empathic faculty, not the scientific one. And this is always creative. And that's what Michael Levin's point is, because the information is not there. There must be creation, like information creation there. And it's really weird because from an information theoretical point of view, where is this information coming from? Like the genes don't store the blueprint of my body yet from a single cell. Even the single cell doesn't store the blueprint of my body yet. Through dynamic processes, it's built. And this building is always expansive. And this is, I think, what Louis is talking about. This is the transposition, where you take the piano piece, or even better, take the score. The score is a very good example, because the score is a sheet of digital information. The musician sits down and puts into the performance his or her creativity. We even call it that, you know, performing arts exist because the score doesn't contain all everything we want to hear or that touches us, you know. And this performance is what actually becomes then, it becomes an embodied experience when I hear it, you know. And this is where awe and a lot of things come from. And this is the mystery, because where does those creative things come from? You know, that's really, really strange. It's more a top-down thing than a bottom-up.
Yes, yes. I was thinking about this a lot today, preparing for our conversation as well, because I feel like, you know, as you're speaking, to me, this is such a witness for, I hesitate to use the word proof, because I don't know that we know those kind of things in a deductively certain way, but evidence for the reality of a non-material, you know, mental kind of being. I just don't think meaning and transposition and all the things that we're discussing can be explainable on this, you know, on a purely materialistic level, because of what you're saying, that there's some kind of mind, creativity, something from above necessary, even for the very ordinary experience of using our memory. And I think about, as what you're saying, I'm very excited about your bow tie idea. And Karen, if you're okay with talking about this a little bit, because I, one of my side projects is working on a literary theory, Balaj, that I think you will find resonates with what you're talking about and what you're thinking about. So if we think of, maybe let's talk about the pianist who sees this score and knows that this was a symphony, but had never heard the symphony before, right? And the person who had heard a different symphony, who has a memory in their imagination of what symphony is, can look at the transposed lower level and creatively imagine, call forth, you know, reconstruct, creatively imagine how it might become a symphony again. But that would take that work of the imagination, work of the mind's own creativity to revivify, let's say, the lower medium's record of the music. And I wonder if we do something similar with our memories, you know, that let's say memories, I've never thought about this, and I think this is really fascinating. You know, I can imagine that there's, well, I know a little bit about the myelination of the brain, that maybe certain memories are stored in neural patterns. I'm not exactly sure what the material imprint would be, but that my living experience of the present would allow me and my mind and my will and my intentionality and my imagination and my creativity to take the physical imprint of the past and revivify it, bring that music back to life again. But, you know, and I think that's why, yes, but that you couldn't fully store a real memory within merely a physical stratum. So like the music, that the piano music that can't contain within itself the symphony level. So our material level of memory can't contain within it the lived dynamic level, but we can with our own creative mental capacity bring it back to life. That's some of what you're talking about.
Yes. No, this is exactly what I'm saying. Yeah. Yes, and this is always a creative act. And this is where LLMs do this creative act randomly. So it does something, and you know, if you don't know me, what I say might look random, as you said.
Yeah.
But I think there is more there. It's a choice. It's a choice of
well,
some
so,
kind
so
of consciousness.
Let me throw something in here. Balazs, as you were talking about both of you talking about all these things and about creative acts and all of those things, but I just want to simplify it way down. And I've thought a lot about this bow tie thing. I was so excited when Michael Levin started talking about it, because I've been thinking about it for years, just in terms of a literary term called chiasm. And I don't know if you've ever heard me talk about chiasm. Okay, so I probably should let Annie talk about chiasm, but chiasm is a certain literary structure that shows up in a lot of ancient texts, and it's quite prominent in the Bible. It shows up in both the Old Testament and the New Testament. And the basic structure would be that you're trying to communicate something very important. So there's actually a pattern that shows up in the text where there will be a statement, and then the next statement, let's say statement A1, statement B1, statement C1, and then statement D. And then it will open back out again, and it will be statement C2, B2, A2. So these two outside statements are parallel, and then the next two in are parallel and parallel until you come to this center point. And it was done for the purpose of really emphasizing this central point. This is where you're supposed to look. And I was thinking about this literary thing, and it occurred to me one day, like 28 years ago, I was tasked with teaching a Bible study on the life of Joseph in the Old Testament. You familiar with Joseph's life at all, Balazs?
Remind me.
Okay, so he was one of Israel's sons, one of his 12 sons. He was like the favored son. His father gave him a beautiful coat of many colors, and then the brothers got jealous, and they threw him in a pit, and they sold him off to slavery in Egypt. So he starts out with a broad life filled with riches and dreams and purposes.
I see where you're going.
And then his life gets narrower and narrower. So he's thrown in a pit, sold into slavery. The first place he ends up is Potiphar's house, where he's a slave or a servant to Potiphar. And then Potiphar's wife wants him, and he refuses her because he's a moral young man. So she claims that he took her by force. So then he's thrown into prison. And so it's just one thing after another until his life is very small, prison. But then something happens. I'm not going to go into all that. He's able to explain a dream to the Pharaoh of Egypt. And out of that, he ends up becoming the second in command over all of Egypt and controlling the entire nation. So his life is like a chiasm.
I see.
And I'm thinking, well, Jesus's life is the perfect chiasm, because he starts out in glory in heaven and gives all of that up to come down through this very narrow tunnel of becoming a human being to start with, and then even narrower of going through the death of crucifixion, and then coming out on the other side into resurrection. And then through history ever since then, his impact has grown and grown and grown across the planet. So it's this chiastic structure. And as I have been looking at this stuff on my channel for like 6 years, trying to see how all these things scale, I was seeing that chiastic structure in every level of reality in many places. And then when Levin started talking about, well, actually, even before Levin started talking about bow ties, one of the guys that had been on my channel a few times decided to leave coding because he could kind of see AI was coming along and was going to eat all the coding jobs. So he went back to school and got a degree in psychology. And one of the psychological theories that he had stumbled across was something called bow tie theory, talking about bow ties in the neural pathways in the brain. And I don't remember what all it was, but it was because it was bow tie theory that got it on my radar as bow tie as being the term. So then when Michael Levin started talking about bow tie, I'm like, oh yeah, because it shows up everywhere. So
yeah, no, yeah, it does actually.
Karen,
go ahead.
Well, I forgot the reason I brought that up.
No, it's okay.
Is that every choice, every choice we make is a bow tie.
Yeah.
Because on my entire world history of my life, all of my memories, every song I've ever heard has affected the way I think about the world. Every book I've ever read, all of that comes down to this one moment of choosing left or right, choosing yes or no. And then after that choice, it's going to open up again. And
that's
and
really good.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's really good. And you know, Karen, the hero's journey is that shape.
Exactly. That's what I wanted to say. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it's very general.
Yes. And it is the pattern is everywhere. And so the approach to literature that I mentioned before is similar in the sense of, I get this from Dorothy Sayers, who wrote a book called The Mind of the Maker. And in the
you
mind
really
of the
maker. You should read that, Balaj. I think it would help your work immensely. It's an amazing book.
Yes, yeah, so which her theory is that as an artist, as a creative writer, she attends to her experience of creativity. And in her experience of creativity, she notices a triune pattern to that process. And so she meditates on what her experience as an author might illuminate about the Christian doctrine of the Trinity. And basically what she says is that she finds in herself some kind of unknown, unseen impetus or origin of an idea, this itch, right, that you might feel. And then you desire expression. And so you stretch for that right word, that right manifestation, incarnation, which would be equivalent to the Son, right? So the unknown origin or impetus or source would be like the Father, who is not seen, who's an invisible light, inaccessible, and yet he incarnates the idea, you know, an incarnation of the creative idea that becomes the spoken word or the painted picture. And that if that process happens rightly, the incarnate word or manifestation will have power. It will respond. You will respond to it, right? So if I have this idea right now, I'm grasping it and trying to incarnate through my words. And if that process happens rightly, it will have power in you. It will resonate with something in you. And that is analogical to the power of the spirit, right? And she draws from Augustine's De Trinitate on the Trinity, where Augustine says, if God is a Trinity, and he is the origin of all things, and he's created this world to be a manifestation of his character, that the creation is an icon or a reflection of the creator, then we should expect to find this triune pattern. You know, it'd be interesting to see the bow tie and the triune pattern, if there's some parallels there, but we should see these trinities everywhere. And so Dorothy Sayers, she says, oh yes, I experience this kind of triune pattern in my own creativity. And what I've been doing is saying, well, if there's a triune pattern to the creation of art, to the creation of literature, is there not also a triune pattern to the reception or the reading of art? Because, and this has to do with that transposition, right? So the artist takes the idea up here and puts it into printed words on a page, little black strokes on a paper, you know, that's a lower medium. I, the reader, come to that lower medium, and it's a creative act by which I read the words and I reincarnate it, right? I try to listen to the inner word present, reincarnate that with my own imagination, and allow it to have power in me. And so, if that makes sense, and I think that that is that connecting to this bow tie idea.
Absolutely. Well, I want to talk about or maybe get into is a self-transformation, because this all is there actually. So John Verrecki talks about, I don't remember what the terminology is, but the way he reads perspectively is not just reading the book, sitting there and just reading, but also say it out loud. And this is one of his techniques to actually relive the great philosophers that he likes, not the propositions they say, but try to recreate those words they were living in and understand them from the inside, right?
Oh, is that when he talks about Lectio Divina?
Exactly, that's it.
Okay.
That's it. Yeah. And so, and he talks about the imaginal, which is a Jungian term for imagination, that actually the goal is not just to imagine, but to become. And kids do it when they dress up as Zorro or they dress up as a pirate, and they actually live how it is to be like a pirate from the inside. And these are tools, John talks about it, but in general, these are tools of self-transformation. And this is when I listened to Luis, that's what I felt that he was getting at, that these are techniques, or these are actually processes that we naturally use or we can learn, that lead to self-transformation, of which the biggest one is death, after which, in his framework, there is the afterlife, but it works also, you know, every time you change, which is probably, or every time I change, or which is every moment actually, but you can sort of model the big changes in your life or in my life by this process of the hero's journey. The hero's journey is about transformation. The hero is transformed from the little boy to the adult, right? That's the basic Jungian setup. So all this leads to that sort of like a change in time of these living organisms. Some of them are biologically pushed, like growing up, maturing, but some of them are not. And this is where it relates to my own life, which is when I became adult. As an adult, I can change, I can choose not to change. Or, I mean, not really, but let's say stick to my way of existing, or I can explore those possibilities of change, which are very painful, because you have to get into this hole of Joseph and then grow out of it again. And I went through like two, three of those sort of like, you can call it midlife crisis or you know, some really heavy stuff. And I got the taste of it. And so one reason why I'm interested in all this, even just from a psychological point of view, is to understand those self-transformations that John talks about it a lot, and like L.A. Poe's book about the impossibility of deciding to go through the hero journey, because you don't know the value system, you don't know who you become at the end, so you cannot really decide rationally from the point of view of that person who you will become, which means you decide it in some other way. And that other ways again leads to a mystic thing, like how do we like that guy who decided to become a psychologist after coding, like that wasn't a rational decision from a decision theoretical point of view, because the information, the value system wasn't there when he decided it. So this is why where it resonated a lot with me. The thing is, like, afterlife, yeah, maybe not, I don't know for sure, but for sure it works for in this life, in this world, for guiding self-transformation. So that's why this resonated me so much.
I'd like to take this and simplify it down a little bit. Annie, you can hold on to that thought that Balazs just had and follow up with it. But if you think about this at the very basic level of change and transformation and growth, years ago, 2017, I guess, I ran into Jordan Peterson, and then I read his book Maps of Meaning. And there's a chapter in Maps of Meaning called Anomaly. It's the chapter 4. And reading through that chapter, my mind was just exploding over and over and over, because I was seeing art in every paragraph. Wasn't talking about art. He was talking about how anomaly jumpstarts transformation. So I was thinking of anomaly as a creative process. And I was trying to understand at that time, I was looking at evolution and creation, special creation, and trying to understand, because for me, I could see both of them. I could see how either one of them, even when you listen to Jordan Peterson lecture and he's talking all about how this thing evolved, we know this thing evolved because of XYZ, I was thinking you could as equally say, we know that that thing was created because of XYZ. They're using the same data point, but they're coming to two different conclusions. So I was trying to understand this whole thing. And so I was holding it. And then I read this chapter on anomaly and I thought, well, perhaps that's how something could gain enough information to go from being a very simple single-celled organism to becoming a very, because you have to have a huge gain in information in the DNA from I think there's 500 base pairs on the simplest organism they've been able to come across that's still alive, compared to 3.4 billion base pairs in a human DNA. So where does all that information come from? And whenever there's an anomaly, you have to adapt to the anomaly. And so that kind of adaptation can increase information. So I began to think about this concept of anomaly, and certainly in my life, when anomalies have occurred, they've been transformational. Anomaly being something that throws you in the pit, something that creates enormous chaos in your life, something traumatic, something painful, a huge life shakeup. Those kinds of anomalies, you either adapt or you give up. And if you're not going to give up, you're going to adapt. And that adaptation changes you. It transforms you. It increases your capacity. It increases your knowledge. And if you're looking at the game of life, those little cells are moving across the screen. If you inject some sort of anomaly, or in AI, I understand that sometimes they inject noise to get some extra creativity out of the, I don't know exactly how that works, but it's this idea that anomaly in my life has always been perfectly suited to my need, as though the anomaly itself is a gift that's perfectly suited to me and to nobody else. Because the same event that might create chaos in my life actually changes somebody else's life in a completely different way. So if there was some sort of way that evolution is producing more and more and more information, I was theorizing that perhaps it's because those anomalies that the simple creatures are adapting to are especially suited to whatever the need was for that adaptation at the moment to help. Now, I know that's a very strange idea, but that got me thinking about anomaly. And anomaly is the hinge point of every bow tie.
And I agree. I agree. And this is a big mystery. The anomaly is the random, right? So the question is it really random, or is it
Is it
just some
really
other
random?
organism who was doing something that I have no access to? I cannot understand it. I can only see the result. And I can completely imagine a metaphysics where it's a conscious choice all the way down, and that exists. I mean, there are panpsychist frames like that do this, and it's consistent. I think it's consistent. I mean, all what we see random could be some kind of internal choice of some organism that we have no access to. And in that sense, I understand completely the internal feeling also as anomalies, as if there was a reason why it happened to you, right?
Because it notice, Karen, in your idea of like for an anomaly to grow information, the context has to be an already functional system that desires to grow.
And
So
the
the
desire is the
prerequisite.
thing they can never explain.
That's
Why
right.
does it want to live?
There's a great book, I don't know, Balaj, if you've heard of it, called Purpose and Desire by Scott Turner.
Oh no, but it sounds great. Is he the one,
And
the same
I,
one that wrote the book on imagination?
no,
Oh, okay.
he's a biologist and he's not a Christian. So I like to sometimes recommend his book coming from, he's panpsychist, but he does a very interesting
What was the
analysis
title
of
again?
purpose and
Purpose and
desire.
desire, okay.
His interesting analysis on the biological level, he's really pushing scientists to recognize that you can't actually get rid of intentionality and purpose. It is assumed. There's a great quote where, teleology, the word for purpose and desire, is the biologist's mistress. He enjoys her in private, but doesn't want to be seen with her in public.
I know.
Right?
That's true.
That's true. So just,
That's
I just
true.
want to point out to your analogy, there's assumed functionality and intentionality. They're still present in order to do anything with the anomaly. Because you know what? Dust doesn't care about the anomaly. Right? It takes some kind of pre-existing will, desire. And that, I don't know if we want to go there. I'll propose this, but as I was thinking of AI and transposition, what it seems to me, and again, as a layperson, that everyone's worried is, are the AI computers going to become conscious, and are they equivalent to human? Are they going to take over? All these kind of concerns because this technology is so amazing, and the way that it functions is beyond the grasp, the comprehension of most of us. But it seems to me, if we think about this idea of transposition, the lower medium and the higher medium, and the AI is working at the level of bits and electricity, and that its substratum is here, and then we have the language that emerges, let's say, up here, a higher, richer medium of meaning, but that doesn't just happen. That is humans with our intentionality, our imagination, and our meaning providing for the AI at every increasing level the parameters, the necessary randomizers, the data set of information. There was this interview recently with Ross Douthat, sorry, I apologize, Ross. With a guy who quit OpenAI because he thinks in 18 years they're gonna, whatever, take over and kill us. And I was listening, and he and in that conversation, they're saying, well, they're autonomous agents. No, they're not. They're not autonomous agents. This whole like modern idea of autonomy is such a myth, such a spell over our imagination that the Enlightenment people like Rousseau came up with. It's not autonomous. It depends upon our us for energy, us for information, us for the next level of parameters that will enable it to grow. I just don't see that emergence is actually, I don't know why Zoom keeps making these images. I don't know if you guys see those. Sorry about that. That emergence is plausible. I think it's a kind of magic wand, enough time and enough complexity and
Yeah,
higher
of
levels of
course, yeah.
meaning will
I
just
mean,
emerge. But that seems to me cope, like total cope, that when we actually look in detail of meaning systems and how all these things work, that at every level, we are giving our own intentionality and purpose to these things and then forgetting it and then wondering at the creatures of our own hands.
No, yeah. I mean, I think God is a much better studied concept than emergence. Like, emergence is really, I have no idea what's going on, right?
So do you
Whereas
think
if
emergence
he,
is real? Would you say no, emergence is an actual causal reality?
So
Or
there
is it
is bottom
merely
up. I mean, I think both are real. Both emanation and emergence are real. I'm a bit joined on this. Like, it's symmetric, and it both has to be there. I talked to, I don't know if you know Kevin Mitchell, another biologist. He's less well known than Michael Levin, but the same sort of
Ken Mitchell?
Kevin
Kevin
Mitchell.
Mitchell. Okay.
He was my last guest on my podcast. He wrote a book called Free Agents. He has two books. This is a second book, and the point he makes is that even if you just look at physics, the world is not deterministic. That's a myth. That doesn't. We don't know where it comes from. If you look at even just particle decay or quantum mechanics, it is not deterministic, which means that there is a space for top-down causality. He calls this the causal slack. That there is a space for free agency, which manifests itself in complex organism constraining what's going on below, right? And so there is an emergence because we see it. I mean, there is the history of physics becoming chemistry, becoming biology, becoming consciousness, probably, whatever, is your worldview, there is a sort of story we can tell in this way where organisms became more and more complex. And there was a bottom-up process, which I think is based on love, basically. Love, which means that two things want to be together. Very, agapic and abstract way of thinking about love, but that's it. Two particles get together and they form an atom and then a molecule and then a cell and etc. And so there is this bottom-up process, but it was always constrained from above, from the beginning. And so yeah, emergence is real in that sense. And we do have this sort of like big events that recreate the rules. They never really, there is no contradiction between the rules below and the new level, but the new level adds something that wasn't there in the level below. So in that sense, there is emergence, yes. And the rules become completely almost like arbitrary compared to what was below. Like, you cannot predict biology from chemistry. You cannot predict how life looks like, I mean, evolution doesn't predict anything. It just says what exists. So you cannot say that because I know biochemistry, I can predict that humans will look like that. There can be a lot of processes there from the lower level point of view. But that jump happened, okay? In time, and it happens every time when a human is created from a cell. It sort of goes through those steps. And so I know emergence is real. But it's really, it's hard to explain it without the emanation, without the other part, the top down.
Yeah, I think where I might differ, or coming from a classical Christian perspective, would be, we conceive of God as both the origin, the ground,
Yeah, I know, yeah. That's the complicated stuff.
and its end, right? It's the alpha and the omega, both the ground and the goal. And so, whereas when I hear you speaking, and I think in many ways I agree with you, I hear you saying something very simple, similar to Dante in the Divine Comedy, where he says, you know, it's the love that moves the spheres. It's the love of God that animates all things and brings together and turns them in the dance that is this life, right? I would just add, I don't think that that the creation, let's say the things below, can move toward that emergence can't happen without some kind of ground of being. That we contingent things, I don't think connect. You know, I don't keep myself alive. Something else keeps my consciousness going, right? Because my consciousness is a prerequisite to all my other will and intentionality. And so there's something, some mysterious ground of being behind even my consciousness. This was actually an epiphany that was my conversion moment, because I kind of the oldest child who felt responsible for everything. And that I was working so hard as this oldest child, you know, in a chaotic family, to hold it all together and to figure it all out. And, you know, unsurprisingly, I very soon burnt out of trying to hold the whole world together and keep everything going. And I got in my car and took off to Alaska, and I just drove without sleeping for like 4 days straight,
Cool.
smoked a
Okay.
cigarette the whole way. Got to Denali, Alaska, got on my car and just started walking. And then it was like a Forrest Gump moment. I don't know if you know the Forrest Gump movie, where I just had to go and go and go and go until I finally exhausted myself and I sat down. And I honestly expected myself to just like disappear. This existential experience of giving up on sustaining myself. I had so somehow, I think at a subconscious level, perceived that my own life was up to me, that I honestly was surprised to find myself still here. I'm still here. I'm still here. I'm still, I gave, there's this existential experience for me of giving up and then being surprised to find that it's something else actually that sustained me. And that was a real, you know, bow tie moment for me, where from that point forward, I've been conscious of this sense of there's something else holding me. Something else guiding me. And so I think I love that idea of both. There's top-down purposes, constraints, structures. There's also a bottom-up, you know, I think you can think about all things out of love, desiring the good, moving up toward the good. But that God would be both that, the good, ordering good that constrains, and the existential ground that gives life as a gift, so we might be able to participate and move toward him.
Makes a lot of sense. The thing is, I'm still a very left brain heavy person. So this is where I am now. I got from a complete materialist, physicalist atheism to where I am now, which is basically, I completely feel that we are part of something bigger. And honestly, if I'm thinking about Peugeot or Levin's hierarchical fractal system, I don't even understand how it wouldn't be. Like, why would be on the top of this hierarchy? Why? You know, it's, Michael Levin has this fantastic picture of two neurons, two cells in your brain talking about life, you know? And one of them is the atheist one saying, ah, no, we're just swimming here around in this chemical soup, and we are friends, and we are, you know, communicating with each other. But really, there is nothing else to life than that. And the other says, no, I think we are part of some bigger consciousness or something bigger. And of course, our point of view, that second cell is right. Unless you really want to deny everything, but that's really like a performative contradiction. So I don't want to go there. But if this is true, that I don't really understand why, you know, anytime when I get into a relation with somebody, even just talking to you guys, we become, we are three now, and the three of us has a consciousness that's not independent from ours, but it's a different one. And it sort of guides us. It's a constraint. This conversation is a constraint. I will not say everything. I will not go anywhere. and what you're saying is affecting what I'm saying, and somehow we three of us will output something there which will stay there, and it's our consciousness that's sitting on the top of three of us, and this thinking. So I'm not really thinking about who created the world, where it will end up, because these are too far from me. But if I think about just this thinking, how it had my life with my partner, you know, the way like we started to do a sort of like a couples group. And one of the idea there is, okay, you check in as you, your wife checks in as her, and then the relationship checks in. Of course, the relationship can only talk through us, but you can still ask the question, like, what would the relationship say? You know? And so since then it became sort of like a tool, like, okay, we are, you know, we have this and this and this, but what would the relationship say? What would it do? What it would what does it want? And this is a really meaningful question. And you can ask this question at any level, like family, city, country, etc. And it's I'm just, you know, of course, so this is where the emergence stuff comes in. Of course, these levels, they are not the same. They have different rules, they behave differently, and some of them are more tight, like, you know, my two brain halves are sitting in my skull, they cannot really go on their own way, they don't have that choice, you know, without killing the whole system. Me and my partner, we can part way if we want, so we are loser, the connection is loser, but still the principle is there, and the creation of the top-down causes from the couple's point of view are there. It's just like sort of quantitatively different, and even qualitatively maybe different, but there is something common in this. So that made me think, just by, you know, induction, there is something at the top. So that's a sort of God that's sitting at the top of this hierarchy, which is the universe, right? If we get there, I mean, the reason why I was like hesitating a lot with Christianity. Actually, my son got baptized last year by himself, like, you know, he decided it at 17. So we've been talking a lot about this. There are two things why I'm, let's say, hesitant. One is this omnipotent thing. Like, I don't really feel that this thing on the top has attention to every little cell or every human, and I don't feel that attention paid to me, and maybe that's my psychological setup, but in the same way I don't pay attention to every little cell of mine. They do their stuff, and I do emanate constraints into them, like I move them around and they come with me, but I don't, you know, manage the biochemical processes they do, fortunately, because I wouldn't have the attention span. So that's, I think this emanation emergence is more symmetrical, and the attention paid by the hierarchy towards down is not total. There is no, and these questions, like also like bigger questions, like is there like a theological goal of the whole universe towards which it goes? And I'm not sure. This is one. The other is more practical and practices, and maybe you can say something about it, is that again the asymmetry, which is I feel that I'm sitting in the middle of this hierarchy. This is me, my consciousness, me, and I feel a symmetry between the above and the bottom, which means I have a lot of stakes in my body, what's below my consciousness, and I have to take care of it, and I do a lot of practices to do that. And I think the alignment with the high and the low, as it goes through me, I don't see in the Christian practices that concentration on what's going on below the health, the body, the nutrition, the stuff like that, which is more like modern, let's say, because we can, you know, we don't have to eat what is given to us in like rough fields in 1700s. But it's also, you my practices are more oriented towards this than it would be in a Christian rituals. That said, I was really, really moved by the baptism, which was actually in a Latin church, Catholic Latin church, which is almost like Orthodox, you know. And it was very embodied. It was, I didn't understand anything. Nobody really understood anything. We were just going through the motion. It was almost like a, you know, Sufism, these repeated movements that puts you in a mystical state, like a psychedelic state. So that was very similar, but because that was part of the whole ritual. And so I think there's a lot of things in those practices and rituals, etc., but it doesn't touch me enough to go towards it. You know?
Makes sense. On your first point, I very much understand what you're saying about logically inducing, right, atop of the hierarchy. And, you know, it is hard if the top of the hierarchy, God, like the top of my hierarchy, my body, God would have to be some kind of infinite consciousness that would be a kind of thing I, as a finite conscious, limited to being awake and my body, and, you know, would only be able to infer analogically, but not grasp, right? So much of classical theism, and this is where people will talk about that Aquinas's arguments for the existence of God, which are basically logical arguments, like we're talking about, you know, based on my observations of this world, I can logically infer an unmoved mover, a first cause, a highest good. That gives me the God of the philosophers, which is a kind of, you know, necessary being, a kind of transcendent being that is outside that which what my finite mind can grasp. And and I think that's some of where, you know, that makes logical sense. It's not a supremely compelling vision of God, right? It's not going to help me feel a mystical tension between my daily experience and suffering in this moment and the unmoved mover, right? So that jump between the God of the philosophers and the God of Christianity, you know, is a big jump. And I think for me, that's where the narrative element that, let's say, Jordan Peterson talks about really came in, of where seeing in the person Jesus Christ, the archetypal hero's journey, the kind of archetypal man, really feeling that, you know, this was a historical figure I had to reckon with, sort of pulled together the God of the philosophers, this idea that, yeah, I can logically, that makes the most sense of the world for me. But then the man Jesus and his story being one that I, as a human, can find meaning in and participate in is what did the dots for
makes
me.
Sense. It makes sense. Look, there is a big jump there between humongous, enormously big, and infinite. And this is a Platonic jump, and I'm more with. I have a friend, a philosopher called Alexander Bard. I had three times on my podcast, and we'll have a new one. We'll talk about mysticism. Actually, he's a Zoroastrian, and for all goods and purposes, I'm with him on this. I'm not a Zoroastrian because I'm not following any of the rituals. But is your Zoroastrian God is this? This thing that we are part of, but not infinite. So he's always like really, really irritated when infinities are brought in. And he says that it's a Platonistic dualist thing. And I'm with him on this. I don't want to be dualist. It's like almost like a normative thing for me. Like I think it leads to really bad things. Like Gnosticism, especially when you this is this other world where you want to go, and then you know, this is the worst world, and then it really becomes a bad world if you go that way. So that there is this sort of it's again like a hunch. It's not, I cannot say it rationally why, but My actual material as physicalist being was dualist, even if I was thinking I am not, because of the performative contradiction between how I lived and what I thought. And those are two worlds. So I don't want to be dualist. And the move out of this is to say that this God is not infinite. It's just really, really big and much bigger than us. And there are a lot of things he wants. I have no clue, the same way as my neuron doesn't understand why I'm moving around. You know, and so it keeps the universe finite, and maybe that's so. I'm not even sure that it's the philosopher's God, because I'm not going to the infinity. It's a finite thing, but I'm part of it. And on the other thing is that I do feel it, since it's very much again relating back to Lewis, that some feelings that I have now that I had before, and I had an interpretation of those feelings very differently from what I have now when I go through mystic experiences, all kinds. Actually, that I have more mystic experiences too, because now I recognize them, and I do feel that you know, maybe a thought came through me that the thought was not mine. You know, an idea came into my mind. I have no idea from where. It's a little bit like your urge to go to Alaska and just drive and go. It's like, I don't know where it comes from. And I'm comfortable with it, to understand it as it coming from this hypermind that I'm part of. You know, so it's not only a left brain construction. It also, you know, gives me tools and feelings and interpretations of the feelings, and also actions to go towards, to explore it more. And maybe I'll arrive to the Christian, and I don't know, maybe, you know, we'll see.
Yeah, super interesting conversation. This is probably a good place to wrap it up. That's the last thought that I had was that you were talking about love being what draws everything together, Balaj, and as you were talking just now, I was remembering way back to when I first started listening to Paul Vanderclay. He had a guy on there named Chris, who was a mathematician. And Chris was grappling with this idea that there's something about calculus and the asymptotic nature of calculus that's always moving inward and upward, but never getting to, never touching, right? And so if we can, in my mind, if I think of Jesus Christ as being that axis, and as we seek truth, we're getting ever closer and ever further up and ever closer and ever further up, but never touching.
Yes,
so
precisely.
You don't
That's
have to think about infinity in that case. It's just that. And it has to be that way, because otherwise the drive for truth would stop. Truth would arrive, and then we would stop growing. So for us to continue to grow, I think it has to be that way.
The question is the
wrong.
Ontological status of that axis.
There's what?
The ontological status of that axis. Is it real or not? You know, you can move towards something that's not real. You can always be better and better and better. It doesn't have a limit. The limit is you know, math is a big Platonistic thing.
But the axis is truth. So if you look at that axis, this is truth. We know truth exists because that's what we're always moving towards. And maybe I'll send you a lecture by particle physicist. Is it particle physicist? Nima Arkani Hamed. On the fundamental morality of physics, or the fundamental physics of morality. I can never remember which it is, but it's all about truth. And I think that, I mean, maybe we could come back together again if the three of
yes,
us have time and talk
been
about
interesting
that.
Discussion.
I know that Annie has a hard stop here, but you looked like you had one last thing you wanted to say.
Sure, last thought. I very much agree with you, Balaj, about the dangers of dualism, and Yeah, any kind of Gnosticism, it's always, you know, the great enemy of the church, the great enemy that theologians are constantly warding off, and it comes back like Hydra with a new version and a new head. Anyways, another epiphany for me is where I realized that a difference in being, that God is a transcendent, necessary being, and me as the creator and creature, necessary, contingent, infinite, finite, that this difference in being didn't also have to be a division between good and bad. That's the subtle lie. That's the twist. And I really do feel like the Augustinian idea of evil as not a thing at all, but merely a veering away from our telos. It's not a thing. It doesn't have a substance. It doesn't have an ontological reality. It's a sort of reconciles that problem where that difference in being doesn't have to entail the Gnostic negation of body. You know.
I know. I know. You can be dualist without being Gnostic. Yeah, I know. I know. It's just that's. I think the reason why it always comes back, because it's
make that connection for me.
Which one?
Yeah, tell me why. What if they don't have to go together? You can be dualist without agnostic. Then help me understand the sticking point.
Because I think it's like a stepping stone
Oh, that you think.
Towards Gnosticism. Yeah. It's very
Okay.
easy to make that step, and this is why it comes back all the time. Because
Yes.
it's you know, any time you're fed up with God or you're suffering, that's an easy way out if you're dualist. If there is another world where these things happen. And I think we have this world, and in this world this world has this emergentist emanist structure, but there is no other world where these things come from. You know, and so even I don't even like to talk about physical and mental in this sense, because it's the same world.
Yes, right. We never experience them as actually, you know, that's why I think that like form and matter is a better, I like the way of form and matter as a way of discussing, because we never experience anything without both, right? Everything has form and intentionality and purpose embedded in its material structure. So for us, all being is a wedding. Right. And again, that's why the spheres are moved. It's love that moves the spheres, because all of creation is this marriage, this incarnation of form and matter, of purpose and desire and being. Yeah. So I agree, you know, it's a tricky question. We probably
Yes,
are
very tricky.
time to take it further, but I really find your perspective fascinating, and I appreciate you taking the time to answer my questions and flesh it out a little.
Absolutely. It was a really great pleasure. Let's do it again.
Well, I just got really excited at the end there when you were talking, Balazs, because the way you explained it made it so clear to me. I don't know that I'm right at all, but my perspective might shed some light on what you said. My feeling has been for a long time that when the scripture says that those who are in Christ, or who are in him, okay, they are citizens of heaven. So right now I inhabit a different reality than I inhabited before. And Annie inhabits a different reality than she inhabited before, and she and I are inhabiting the same reality. So anyone who is in Christ is inhabiting this other reality. So I am embedded in a reality that other people are inhabiting, but my reality is in Christ, and I am
Yes,
in heaven
that,
right
that's
now.
that's
So,
that's completely okay. I mean, there is the group of people in Christ who actually constitute one big consciousness, and there are other people who are, you know, inhabiting other big consciousnesses, and we live together, we communicate, we actually pretty porous. There is no very strong membrane between. People move around, although they are pretty sticky as the world
Yeah,
is. So
yeah.
they are like.
Well, I can totally understand why you would read it that way, but that's not exactly what I mean. I'm actually talking about reality.
No, but
Almost as
I'm
though
just
there.
giving you my
Yeah.
interpretation of what you say. Of course, it's I know.
No, but I mean, oh
I
no, I'm
understand.
talking as almost as though there, I don't believe in the multiple worlds theory at all, but let's say that there are two worlds and they're coterminous. There's two worlds that are in the same place, almost in the same place, maybe a little bit out of phase. And so, it stepping across the line is not, it's not this big vast gap. Stepping across the line is a moment of coming into Christ brings you into this reality. And it's very hard for me to describe, but
Then of course, because
and Annie would probably say
language
I'm being
is
heretical. I don't know. But I mean, that's the
no,
picture that
I'm
I
only
have.
thinking that my husband is hungry and he's texting me
Me
to
too.
take him to dinner. So this was so fun. Thank you so much, Karen and Balaj.
Yes.
Really a pleasure.
Yeah, maybe we can do it again sometime.
Yeah, thank
Great.
you very
Yeah.
much.
Great talking to
Love
you.
you. Yes,
Bye-bye.
bye bye.